She got out of bed carefully so as not to awaken him, and went naked into the large walk-through closet that separated her bedroom from the dressing room. She switched on the light, chose a white silk gown, shrugged into it, then took a brown terry cloth robe, a man's robe off a hanger, and draped it around a female-shaped dress dummy in the bedroom. She had a thought. Perhaps a spray of perfume between her breasts and a brush of her hair before true sleep. The car might be coming at 7 in the morning, but she recalled that he liked to be up by 5:30. The well-used rose in hand, Negrita walked into the dressing room. A small Tiffany lamp still burned on the table. She smelled the rose, smelled their mingled scents, and put it into a vase. That one would have to be pressed between silk. She picked up her brush and looked into the mirror. The man was standing behind the screen. She could see his face above it, and in the second of calm recognition before terror, she realized it was a perfect killer's face, devoid of emotion, pale, and quite unremarkable. It was the kind of face that blends easily into crowds, and that you don't remember a moment after seeing. She opened her mouth to call for Michael. The bullet hit her in the back of the skull, precisely where the assassin had aimed. He came out, dressed in tight-fitting black, the small pistol with its silencer gripped in a black-gloved hand. He glanced at the little rubber-coated grapple hook that clung to the terrace's railing. The rope trailed down to the courtyard. She was dead and the job was done, but he knew that a British agent was here as well. He looked at his wristwatch. Almost 10 minutes before the car would meet him beyond the gate. Time enough. He started through the closet. And there was the bitch's bedroom, a low candle flickering, a shape in the sheets. He aimed the pistol at its head and steadied his wrist with his other arm, a gunman's pose. The shape jumped with the force of the bullets, and then, like a good artist who must see the results of his craft, he pulled the sheets away from the corpse. Except it was not a corpse. It was a dress dummy with 2 bullet holes in its blank white forehead. The killer panicked and twisted to get off a shot, but a chair slammed against his back and ribs, and he lost the gun before his finger could squeeze. The killer tore the chair out of his combatant's grip before it could be used again. He kicked out, his boot hitting the man's stomach. The assassin flung the chair. Michael saw it coming in the flex of the man's hands. Then the man was on him, fingers clenching around his throat, digging savagely into his windpipe. Michael quickly brought his hands up, breaking the killer's grip, and smashed the palm of his right hand into the man's nose. The assassin staggered back 2 steps, and Michael hit him in the jaw with a quick left and right. The killer's lower lip split open, but he grabbed the collar of Michael's robe, lifted him off his feet, and hurled him through the bedroom door. Michael crashed into the hallway and into one of the suits of armor. The Nazi assassin came through the door, his mouth streaming blood, and as Michael tried to scramble up, a kick caught him in the shoulder and flung him another 8 feet along the hall. The killer picked up a mace, a wooden handle with a 3-foot-long chain attached to an iron ball of jagged spikes, and whirled it gleefully over his head. The medieval weapon swung for Michael's skull, but he ducked its arc and backpedaled out of range. Michael grabbed a metal shield on another suit of armor. He whirled around, catching the mace's next blow as it came at his legs. And then the killer lifted the mace over his head to crush Michael's skull, and Gallatin threw the shield, its edge hitting the other man's knees, chopping his legs out from under him. Michael darted to the wall and pulled a broadsword off its hooks. The German warily regarded the sword and picked up a battle axe, casting the shorter weapon aside. They faced each other for a few seconds, each looking for an opening, and then Michael fainted with a thrust, and the battle axe knocked it aside. The killer lunged in, the axe hit the sword's hilt in a burst of blue sparks, snapping off the blade, leaving Gallatin standing with a nub of nothing. The killer swung the axe at his prey's face. Michael moved in, crowding the killer. And since blows to the assassin's face seemed to do no good, Michael drove his fist into the exposed hollow of the man's armpit. The German fell back against the second floor railing. Michael followed him, drew his arm back to strike at the throat, but suddenly the assassin's arm streaked out, the fleshy hands closing on Michael's neck once more and lifting him off his feet. The killer was holding him almost at arm's length, and in another few seconds the idea would come to throw Michael over the railing to the tiled floor below. There was an oak beam 2 feet above Michael's head, but it was smooth and polished, and there was nothing to hold on to. Michael's arms reached up, fingers grazing the oak. His body trembled violently, a movement the assassin took to be the nearing of death. And for him, it was. Michael Gallatin's right hand began to twist and contort. Beads of sweat ran down his face, and utter agony played across his features. The black hair on the back of his hand rippled, the sinews shifting. The hand gnarled, the knuckles swelled, the flesh turning mottled and thick, the black hair beginning to spread.
You son of a bitch!
Something moved under the assassin's hands, like scurrying ants. The body was getting heavier, thickening. There was a pungent animal smell. The killer opened his eyes and looked up at his victim. He was holding something. It was no longer a man. He tried to throw the thing over the railing, but two pairs of claws dug into the oak beam and latched there. The monster brought up a still human kneecap and hit the assassin in the chin with a power that all but knocked him senseless. The killer released the thing and scrambled away from it. He looked back and saw the monster's claws wrench free of the beam. The thing fell to the floor, hitching and convulsing, and thrashed out of its brown terry cloth robe. And now the assassin, one of the best of his breed, knew the full meaning of horror. The monster righted itself, crawling toward him. It was not yet fully formed, but its green eyes caught and held him, promising agony. The killer's hand closed on a spear. He jabbed at the thing, and it leapt aside, but the spear tip caught it on the malformed left cheek and drew a scarlet line against the black. Then the killer felt fangs snap shut on his ankle. The jaws opened and snapped on the other leg at the calf.
God help me!
The killer threw up his hands to ward it off, but human hands were of no consequence. The beast's claws entered his lungs, ripped away the heaving tissue, drove down into the man's core. And then the snout and the teeth found the pulsing prize, and with two twists of the head, the heart was torn from its vine like an overripe dripping fruit. The heart was crushed between the fangs, and the mouth accepted its juices. The killer's eyes were still open, and his body twitched, but all his blood was flooding out, and there was none left to keep his brain alive. And then, nosing into the gaping hole, the beast began its feeding, tearing with rampant rage at the inner mysteries of a man. Afterward, as the lights of Cairo dimmed and the first violet light of the sun began to come up over the pyramids, something caught between animal and man spasmed and retched in the mansion of the Countess Margrethe. From its mouth flowed grisly lumps and fragments, a creeping red sea that went under the banister and over the edge to the tiled floor below. The naked, retching thing curled itself into a fetal shape, and in that house of the dead, no one heard it weep.